mostly not for application, just for recording.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about space-time at very, very short distances, and the mysteries about this. Those pictures will crop up all over the place in this talk. This is a part of the Hubble Deep Field image. That is just a bunch of music CDs. And this is, well, any guesses? It's a drum. It's a Native American drum on the floor of some, on the ground in some forest. And somehow that will always, this will all somehow come up eventually. Okay, so what is space-time like at short distances? There's a simple Gedanken experiment that, as far as I know, goes back to Heisenberg. He says, let's put together what we know from quantum theory and general relativity and see what we find out. Let's assume we want to resolve some distance more and more precisely. We know from the uncertainty principle that this means that we must have an increasing momentum uncertainty. But momentum gravitates, just like energy gravitates, and so it curves space. So if you have an increasing momentum uncertainty, it should lead to an increasing curvature uncertainty. But if you have an increasing curvature uncertainty, then you get an increasing distance uncertainty again. Because if you don't know how the manifold looks like, you can hardly tell what the distance is between two. So that ultimately means that this snake is biting his own tail, and we end up with a limit to how precise the distances could possibly be resolved. This is a very crude argument, doesn't take into account relativity just yet. But roughly, something like that needs to be expected. And if you do this a little bit more quantitatively, you find out that, of course, there's an estimate for when this fundamental limit is reached, and it's the natural ultraviolet cutoff expected at the so-called Planck length, 10 to the minus 35 meters. Of course, most, I'm not sure about most. I think most of you are Psi students, right? I wanted to say most of you are totally familiar with all of this, but maybe not most of you. I don't know. Okay. They're very good students. I see. All right. Okay. So if the very notion of distance doesn't make sense at distances smaller than the Planck length, 10 to minus 35 meters, then what? What does space-time look like there? Now, there have been a number of studies on this in quantum gravity, just general quantum gravity arguments, basically trying to make more precise what I just went through, but also more detailed studies, and also studies in string theory, which say that basically the outcome of all this could be that the uncertainty relation, which is usually depicted in this way, with the curve being asymptotic to this axis and asymptotic to that axis, this being the physically allowed region. Well, the conclusion was that maybe this is not really how it looks like. Ultimately, this curve might have a finite distance to that line, meaning that one's uncertainty in a position or in a distance measurement could never be smaller than a certain finite amount, which presumably would be at the string or Planck scale. Now, in principle, that could be it. It could just be that this is a fundamental uncertainty, and it doesn't even make sense to think of what might be lying below that sort of scale. On the other hand, there might be some substructure there beyond that scale, and that substructure might be responsible for the particle content that we have, might be responsible for the symmetry structure that we have in nature. So there have been a lot of proposals for what that substructure might be. String theory, foams, causal sets, space-time has been suggested to be emergent in one way or the other. And one of the great things about perimeter is that several key approaches are being developed right here. So far, however, there's no real experimental access to the whole thing, and so there's no consensus. There are competing theories. The problem seems to run very deep. After all, it's been considered for 80 years or so. And if it were easy, somebody would have done. So why is it so deep? I suppose it is because general relativity and quantum field theory, the only two things that we really know, seem to give conflicting indications about what space-time should look like at very small distances. General relativity would have it that space-time ought to be differentiable manifold. It's just most natural to write a general relativity in such a way that it lives on a differentiable Riemannian manifold, Lorentzian manifold. On the other hand, quantum field theory points into the opposite direction. Quantum field theory would indicate that really in order to have the theories well defined, let alone renormalizable, but just to make them well defined, one apparently has to assume that space-time can be described as discrete. So what then? Is space-time ultimately continuous or is it ultimately discrete? So what this talk is about is the following observation. There is one thing that we know can be discrete and continuous at the same time. And maybe the way we handle that thing, we can also handle space-time. And that thing is information. You see, information, if you think of a Mozart recording, okay, it's certainly something smooth, something continuous, the pressure curve, right? But then on your CD, it's all chopped up. It's discrete. Now you may say, well, yeah, but it's not equivalent. There's some loss there, right? Not necessarily. There's some deep theorems that relate the two and show under certain conditions they are completely equivalent and there is no throwing away of anything. So let's try the following. Space-time might be discrete and continuous simultaneously in the same way that information can. Let's see. Maybe that works. So information can be, as we said, like music, pressure wave, something continuous. But of course, information can also come in the form of discrete chunks of letters and numbers and so on. When Claude Shannon in the 1940s first developed information theory, he started out with this sort of information sources, developed all sorts of theorems about them, and then he wondered, well, what about this though? It looks hopeless. It looks as if in order to record a music signal, you would have to record its amplitude at every point in time, or this way, at every point in time, and there are uncountably infinitely many of those. Not just infinitely many, but uncountably infinitely many. So that we can never store. It looks like that's not going to work. But Shannon actually solved the problem. He remembered an older theorem from mathematics, or like a set of theorems called sampling theory. And they relate those two representations of information and show under which circumstances they can be completely equivalent. We can go back and forth. Now, sampling theory is not very well known in physics. I think that this is a pity because actually it's probably, it can be argued it's the most applied theory ever. I mean, it's in number, in terms of number of uses, the most used theory ever because it's actually used in all of analog digital conversion in communication engineering and signal processing and analysis and in scientific data taking. It's all over the place. So here's how the most basic sampling theorem looks like, the so-called Shannon sampling theorem. Even though Shannon only introduced it into information theory, it goes back to Borel and perhaps the idea of it even to Cauchy. So it's like 150 years old. Here's the theorem. It says, assume that the function is band limited. So think of a music signal, band limited, meaning that when you write it, it's as a Fourier transform, you don't need to integrate over all frequencies, only over frequencies from minus omega max to plus omega max, because it doesn't have any other frequency. It has only frequencies within a certain finite range. In the music recording studio, for example, they make sure that this is the case. They take the signal from the microphone, from the band, or from the orchestra, and they pass it through a filter, 20 kilohertz filter, well knowing that we can't hear anyway what is beyond 20 kilohertz. So after the signal's been passed through the low-pass filter of 20 kilohertz, it obeys the conditions of this theorem. It's a function of this form. And then the sampling theorem says that such a function, music signal for example, is completely captured if you capture its amplitude at discrete points in time, as long as on average you take 40,000 seconds samples per second. You see, if the bandwidth is 20 kilohertz, you need to take 40,000 samples per second, almost twice the bandwidth. Those points, the sample points, where you record the amplitude, are pretty arbitrary. You don't have to choose them at particular points. You don't even have to choose them equidistantly. The main point is that the density overall is okay. But if you, the simplest choice is, of course, you choose to sample them equidistantly at the rate of 40,000 per second, and that's what they do again in the recording studio. And those 40,000 amplitude samples are being put on the CD, 40,000 amplitude samples per second. So the spacing of the sample point is 1/2 omega max. And then in your CD player, this is going on. The signal, the filtered signal, but continuous signal, is reconstructed from the samples that are on the CD by this equation here. And that, you see, these are the samples, f of x, n, those values there. And that is an equality sign for a reason. It can be proven that this is exact. There's no error in that. Of course, you have to assume that it's really filtered. But other than that, it's exact. That's where the CDs first come in. Now you may say, wait a moment. I mean, let's look at this. Let's look at this thing again here. I mean, how can this formula here ever reconstruct that thing or that little peak over there? I mean, how is that ever working, right? How can that work? Well, there's no magic really required in this. It's truly, really exact. And the usual traditional proof that you find in textbooks is using Fourier theory, and it's really just three lines. But I don't want to bore you with this because it's really useless. Because for our purpose, if we want to do that for curved space times and so on, Fourier is really no good. Because Fourier is not covariant. Whether you first Fourier transform and then change coordinate systems or the other way around, that's going to be different. So we shouldn't rely on Fourier theory. There's a new method of proof, though, and that's what I'm using. It works like this. I won't bore you with the details, but here's the key point for understanding what is really underlying this whole sampling business, how discrete can be the same as continuous. Two steps. First step is to realize that if the space of functions that we deal with is finite dimensional, let's say n dimensional, then the sampling issue is trivial. Always a sampling theorem. Well, generically, that's a sampling theorem. And to see that, look at it this way. Consider a function space which is specified by n basis functions. Okay, so every function in our function space is a linear combination of n given basis functions. So obviously, if you know the coefficients of that function in that basis, then you know the function, and you know it everywhere, right? Because you know the function. So what we really need to know is what are the coefficients of the function in the basis. Now assume somebody tells you what values this function takes at n points. Well, then you can write down n equations, and generically, that allows you to solve for the n unknowns, the n coefficients, in a linear combination that f is of the basis function. In principle, it could be that you can't solve for the n equations, but that is only a set of measure zero when this happens. And in the case of the Shannon sampling theorem, it just never happens in proof. So you see the point. An arbitrary function is a linear combination of n basis functions. All you need to know it, is the n coefficient. If you know the function at n points, you get n equations, gives you the n coefficients. There you go. From knowing the function only at n points, you can reconstruct the function everywhere. And then in step two, you do the following. If the function space is really suitable, then you first truncate it to finite dimension, and then let the dimension go to infinity, And that limit would be okay if the function space is really a space of bandwidth functions, or in any case, a space of functions that have a sampling theorem. And we will later use that strategy at one point. Yep?
Quick to be said about how sensitive this process is to the accuracy of the sampling?
Yes. Yes, there's a whole theory about it.
You see, sampling theory is something that books have been written about. There are regular conferences about it. And a lot of work focuses on what happens if you lost a sample, been erased on the disk or whatnot, or you measured it imprecisely, or you don't know exactly when you measured it, and so on. And there are lots of stability theorems about it, and the message is that it's stable. As long as you sample at least at the rate of 40,000 per second, in the case of 20 kilohertz bandwidth, the reconstruction is stable, which means that, technically speaking, a little L2 error in the sample space translates into a bounded capital L2 error of the reconstructed continuous function. But of course, that's something you want to keep. Yep?
Restriction of band limited, or
yes, we will generalize the notion of band limited, because band limited itself is a Fourier notion, and we can't.
Well, but more than that, I mean, if you start off assuming that there are no modes smaller than L Planck, yeah, in quantum field theory, you already put aside lots and lots and lots of issues, and that may be the right answer. But are you assuming that, or are you making it? Or are you going to say something applicable to quantum field theory and the limit to cutoff goes away?
No, I will keep the cutoff. I will assume it to be either a fundamental or an effective natural algebraic cutoff. OK, now, once you have a function space which is band limited, then calculus becomes really fun. Because, you know, things hold true that normally you wouldn't even think possibly could be true. Differential operators are now also finite difference operators, and in many cases also vice versa. Differential equations are also finite difference equations, because, you know, if everything is contained in discrete samples, then anything you do with them, you could view as having done to the continuous function as well, and vice versa. Integrals are also series, and series are integrals.
In particular, this is an equality here. There's no approximation. This is not like a Riemann sum where you have to take a limit. This thing is exact. And it's actually quite useful. Well, so far it hasn't been used in physics much or at all. I'm only proposing this now. But in analytic number theory, for example, this is a rather standard trick. You see, in number theory, you often end up having some terrible series to sum up. And series tend to be terrible more easily than integrals. You see, integrals can be handled in many different ways. You can do substitution, you can do integration by part, you can do contour integration. You know, we have an arsenal of tools. But for series, what do we have? Right? You try induction, perhaps, but that's hard. So what this allows you to do is the following. You look at your series that you have to sum up, and you view the terms in the series as samples of a band-limited function. Rewrite your series as an integral, and then throw contour integration or whatnot at it. And in this way, a lot of series can be solved. It would be nice to have that sort of tool also in physics, perhaps, especially if you have a discrete theory. So let's see, can we do that in physics? Can we replicate that in physics, what we know from communication engineering? So concretely, let's stick with the Euclidean signature case for now. I have also written on the Lorentzian signature case, and others have. But let's keep things simple for now. Let's look at the Euclidean signature case, so just Riemannian manifold. Let's ask, could there be a natural ultraviolet cutoff in nature such that fields possess a suitable finite spatial bandwidth so that we have this sampling property? I say suitable because we know that the usual Fourier notion is not going to work on curved spaces. What would be the benefit if that could be done? Well, here are some consequences. Fields would have equivalent representations on a space-time manifold, but also on any lattice of sufficiently dense spacing. And remember that we are not subscribing to any particular lattice here. Any lattice will do that has a suitable density of the sample point. So the same is true for actions and equations of motion. They could all be written as living on this continuous space-time manifold, but also on any lattice of sufficiently dense spacing. Since all the lattices of sufficiently dense spacing come into this democratically, we're not actually breaking any symmetries here, external symmetries, or even Killing vector fields. They would still be maintained. And the fact that we can write this here in a lattice will ensure that we have ultraviolet finite. So can it be done? Well, yes, that much is not so hard. We can generalize the notion of band limitation to fields on curved space in the following way. So let's look at the Laplacian operator on curved space. And let us cut off the spectrum of the Laplace operator at the Planck scale. Concretely, what does it mean? Think of the path integral in quantum field theory, for example. There you are supposed to sum of all fields in the path integral, of all possible fields. And it's usually not quite specified what's the space of fields. But, you know, roughly speaking, all fields. And for each field you get an action, you have to sum that up. Now, with this cutoff, what we're saying is, no, we're not summing of all fields. We're summing only over those fields that are linear combinations of the eigenfunctions of the Laplacian up to a certain maximum eigenvalue. On flat space, that's exactly the same as a band limitation. Because what is the Laplacian? It's like the momentum squared. If you cut that off, you cut off the frequency. So the space of function that we sum over in the path integral, for example, would be cut off. So the space, the set of quantum fluctuations that we are considering is restricted. This procedure is actually coordinate system independent. It's a covariant thing to do because the Laplacian is a scalar operator. Its spectrum is scalar. Cutting off the spectrum is scalar. We don't have to specify a coordinate system to specify what we do here. But if we do that, I mean, that much is easy. Just impose this ultraviolet cutoff. Do we get any benefit out of it? Well, let's see. Let's say we look at a finite chunk of space-time. Could, of course, be much bigger than this. It could be billions of light years across. But finite in size. Then it is a general theorem of differential geometry that the Laplace operator on any finite volume piece of space has a discrete spectrum which has no accumulation point. Which means that if you cut off the spectrum somewhere, as we do here, then you have only a finite number of eigenvalues. The number of eigenvalues of the Laplacian below the Planck cutoff is finite. But now remember how that strategy went for proving a sampling theorem. The first point was that if your function space is finite dimensional, then we're in business already. And if for finite dimensional function space, there is always a sampling theorem. If the function space is n-dimensional, then it suffices to know a function at n generic points, and you can reconstruct the function everywhere. Same here. If we impose the ultraviolet cutoff, then, so we have an infrared cutoff, we have a finite chunk of space-time, we have an ultraviolet cutoff, we cut off the spectrum, then we know that the function space spanned by the eigenfunctions of the Laplacian up to the cutoff is finite dimensional, let's call it n-dimensional. And then it suffices to know any such function at n points, at n generic points, and you can reconstruct that function everywhere. See? Yes, the Euclidean signature.
Yes, I will get to that. Please remind me if I don't, but I will mention it.
Yes, so we know now that for a finite chunk of space, a finite number, for a finite volume of space, a finite number n of sample points will suffice, we can reconstruct the function everywhere. Big question, of course, is what happens if we remove the infrared cutoff? If we make that chunk of space bigger and bigger and bigger until it eventually is infinite in size, then we expect that the number of sample points that we have to take also grows to infinity. And the big question is, what is the ratio doing? The number of samples that I have to take divided by the volume, that's the sample density. Does it stay finite as we let the volume of that space go to infinity? Now it turns out, and I published that in a paper of last year, that it stays finite, and it stays finite at the value that you would expect just from the Shannon analogy. And to prove that, one uses an old theorem from spectral geometry called Weyl's asymptotic formula. So the message is, yes, it can be done. And so this is for zero forms. This is just for regular functions. It can also be generalized to arbitrary n forms, but that's not published yet. And I'm afraid I don't have time for that now. But if you have questions about it, I can tell you later. And a key point I want to make is that in order to prove that sampling theory works on curved spaces, I had to use spectral geometry. So what is spectral geometry?
Some people would say, not that you don't have enough degrees, even that you have too many.
Yes.
That the right answer should be the surface area, not the volume.
Yes.
I have the slide at the very end on this.
Okay.
Please remind me if I don't get to it, because it's after the last slide. It's for in case this question comes up. All right, so what is spectral geometry? Many of you may know what spectral geometry is. In case you don't, here is what it is. Spectral geometry was popularized by Mark Hutch in 1966, who wrote a paper asking, can one hear the shape of a drum? So imagine you hear somebody play the drum, but you don't see the drum. I'm in the forest, but you're far away. There are trees in between you and the player. And now the drum might be circular in shape, or it might be just like this Nicky American drum here, like the an octagon. Now it's clear that the shape of the drum is going to affect how it sounds. And you can easily convince yourself that it's the spectrum of the Laplacian that you really hear. So what he asked is, if you know only the spectrum of the Laplacian of the manifold, can you tell how the manifold looks? So from listening to a drum, can you tell what the drum looks like?
This is this Native American drum. That's a circular steel drum. And you can actually show that this spectrum could not come from that drum. It turns out that the answer is a yes. You can hear that, except there are some exceptions. But those exceptions tend to be special cases. You don't get that in the generic situation. And in any case, what we'll be interested in here is not so much how the boundary conditions affect the sound of the drum, but we'll be interested, of course, in how the shape of the membrane is going to affect its sound. So you can think of a very large membrane, let's say a very large Riemannian manifold, for example, and think of it as made out of tin or some other metal. And then you bang on it and listen to it. And then the question is, can you hear from the sound what the shape of it is? And the answer is, generally, you can. The eigenvalues of the Laplacian change continuously with the shape of the manifold.
Topology of the manifold?
Yes, and you can hear it. You have to.
Well, I know, but I mean.
Yes, OK. Well, this is a subtleties. I mean, obviously, Rob knows about this thing.
The thing is that I was talking so far just about the Laplacian on zero forms, on function. But the Laplacian can also act on all four. And it turns out that, for example, the if you know the spectrum of those Laplacians on zero forms, one form, two form, three, and four form, it turns out that the degeneracy of the eigenvalue zero coincides with the so-called Betti number of the manifold. So you can hear connectivity properties of the manifold even. But you may have to look at more than just the Laplacian on scalars. You may have to look at the Laplacian on differential form. So the message here is that, roughly speaking, the shape of a manifold generically is determined by the spectrum of its Laplacian. The opposite is obvious, right? I mean, if you know the manifold, then yes, of course, the Laplacian is uniquely determined, and you can calculate the spectrum. The non-trivial part is the other way around. And it's an essentially yes. So that sort of theory has been used to prove that sampling theory can be done on curved Riemannian manifolds. But this was about functions that live on a given Riemannian manifold. How can we sample those functions and reconstruct those functions? Now let's try something a little bit more difficult. Can we do sampling of space-time itself? You see, here the idea is, assume you have a Riemannian manifold. The question is, can you sample some property of it at discrete points and then reconstruct what that manifold looks like everywhere? Of course, you're assuming here an ultraviolet cutoff, right? But assuming that we have this ultraviolet cutoff, is it possible to sample something on that manifold at discrete points and then be able to reconstruct the shape of the manifold everywhere? Now, one's first thought might be, well, I described the non-triviality of the shape of a manifold usually through the non-triviality of parallel transport. But this, well, I thought about it, but it doesn't seem to work. We don't seem to get a sampling theorem when we try it this way. But maybe we should remember Einstein, who wrote some 80 years ago in a little textbook that he wrote on general relativity. He wrote that one shouldn't get too married to the idea that the non-trivial shape of a manifold expresses itself only in the non-triviality of parallel transport. After all, he argues, it also manifests itself in the non-triviality of mutual distances of points. Or in other words, it manifests itself in the violation of Pythagoras. Okay? I mean, if you have like a dozen points or 100 points and so on, then in principle, there are lots of relations between those distances because of Pythagoras. But if the space is curved, Pythagoras is violated. If you measure lots of distances, you should be able to calculate the violations of Pythagoras and therefore reconstruct the shape of the space. He hasn't carried this through, but made the point that you can describe the shape of a manifold in principle through the non-triviality of mutual distances of discrete points. Let's try something like that, and that will actually work. The basic idea is this, that the non-trivial shape of a manifold expresses itself in non-trivial distance relations, following Einstein here, and non-trivial distance relations manifest themselves, for example, in non-trivial two-point correlators. What I mean by this is the following. We can't really measure the geodesic distance between two points before we know what the manifold shape is in between the two. So we can't really go about measuring distances, distance relations right away. But what we could do in principle is sample two-point functions, correlators, quantum field theoretical correlators. And we know that the further away two points are, the less they are correlated, the less the fields are correlated between two points. So it's a rough way of measuring distances. And you may think, well, that's going to be really messy, right? He's going to sample now between n points in the space. He's going to sample the mutual two-point correlators, which the further away the points are, the less they are correlated. And then how on earth do you reconstruct the shape of the manifold from that data? It turns out there is a shortcut that's very short. You can do this, and it's totally short. And the way it works is this. So you choose a finite chunk of your space so that a finite number of sample points should suffice. Remember, we have an ultraviolet cutoff. Finite number n of sample points should suffice. What we measure is the propagator or correlator between all of those n points. You put any one of the n points over here and any one of the n points over there, calculate the propagator. Basically, 1 over the Laplacian in your Euclidean way. There could be mass square in there and so on, but basically, that's what it is. And now the important observation is that if you know all those matrix elements, you get 1 over the Laplacian as a matrix, as an n by n matrix, which means that you get its eigenvalue, right? You have it as a matrix. You have the Laplacian in some basis, and so you can calculate its eigenvalue. But if you have its eigenvalues, spectral geometry tells us you essentially have the space, you have the shape of the manifold right there. It may be hard to calculate in practice, but it's determined already. So that means that a piece of Euclidean signature space-time with this ultraviolet cutoff is not just one manifold, but it's the equivalent class of all those Riemannian manifolds which have the same spectrum up to the ultraviolet cutoff. You see, we don't have eigenvalues larger than the cutoff. And in order to describe a manifold totally, you would need to know the eigenvalues of its Laplacian arbitrarily high. We don't. We have this cutoff. And we couldn't possibly measure the higher eigenvalues higher than the Planck scale. So we have to accept that all those Riemannian manifolds whose Laplacians have a spectrum that agrees up to the cutoff but may differ beyond the cutoff look the same to us. We can't possibly resolve that because we have the ultraviolet cutoff. Whatever we do with fields, we can never resolve whether we use one Riemannian manifold or another Riemannian manifold as long as their spectrum is the same up to the cutoff. So a spacetime with this cutoff is an equivalent class of Riemannian manifolds that share the same eigenvalues up to the cutoff. Yep?
How do I know I've reconstructed it sufficiently accurately for a given value of n? And if I want to improve my accuracy, what's the growth rate with respect to n?
Well, may I refer you to my paper on this? it's a complicated issue, really. It comes back to the question that Lee raised about the stability of the reconstruction. And basically, you can read off from the matrices in question. You have to invert certain matrices for the reconstruction. And there is a threshold. If you sample enough sample points, then you have stable reconstruction. If you don't sample enough sample points, then you don't have stable reconstruction. And you can tell that. You can tell when things go bad. And you can tell it by looking at the matrix, the calculate the max and the minimum eigenvalue of the matrix that you have to invert, so-called condition number. And the condition number tells you how hard it is to invert a certain matrix, and eventually it's impossible. If you don't take enough sample points, it's impossible to invert the matrix, and that's how you know that you haven't sampled enough sample points. But it's a complicated issue.
But as soon as I have a minimum n allows me to invert, I don't need any more.
No, then you don't need any more. In fact, if you take more, you only increase stability, but you don't increase the precision. Because you know the field or you don't. You know the space of eigenvalues or you don't. But it's nice that you can actually intrinsically realize that. You go about measuring sample points and so on. There are sampling points, and then calculate, try to reconstruct, and you can see in the numbers, in the calculation, that you have to invert a certain matrix as you get closer. Or if you have enough points and you take the right view, you see how things go back. It's basically a generalization of the stability studies that are done in usual Shannon sampling theory. Okay, so there's a representation theoretic view of this. Maybe I'm just repeating myself here. So remember that in general relativity, the choice of coordinate system is sort of irrelevant. It's just a choice of representation of something that's not affected by this, namely the underlying Riemannian manifold. You can think of the underlying Riemannian manifold as having some particular shape. And that doesn't depend at all on what sort of coordinate system you put on it. The choice of coordinate system is merely a matter of representation. Now, if there is this ultraviolet cutoff, then one has a further feature here, namely, even the choice of Riemannian manifold is now merely a choice of representation. It's merely a choice of representation of an underlying spacetime with ultraviolet cutoff. The spacetime with ultraviolet cutoff is determined by the eigenvalues up to the cutoff. And there are many Riemannian manifolds that you can use to represent that. Any Riemannian manifold that has the right spectrum up to the cutoff. So which one you choose is, again, just a matter of representation. And because the space of fields is band limited, you can never conceive of an experiment that would distinguish one representation from the other. Yeah?
Does the same spectrum have a representation with a Riemannian manifold of any dimension, of each dimension?
Actually, that's an interesting point. The dimension is encoded in the asymptotic behavior of the eigenvalues.
Represents a manifold.
That's right.
Given the magic.
That's right. You have to have a particular scaling of the eigenvalues at the end. And so that's something that you may want to impose as a special constraint on which Riemannian manifold you can use. Again, I have something about that in the paper, but
It would take a little while to do this.
Non-integer dimension, IS is.
Well, you can certainly work with spectra that corresponds to no
Riemannian manifold of a fixed integer dimension. But I don't know whether you can vice versa work with fractals and see them as having a particular asymptotic behavior under Laplace. I'm not sure about that. But you can certainly work with graphs and work with graph Laplacian. And then you can look at the spectrum of the graph Laplacian, and that spectrum you could also represent as a continuous manifold. And one of my suggestions would be to look into this, because then you can have a discrete structure and view it as equivalent to a continuous structure. And hopefully we actually get an embedding of the graph in that manifold. Okay. Now, the dynamics of space-time. So far, this has all been just kinematics. And you may wonder, well, all right, I can certainly write down the usual sort of dynamics now. For example, I write down the action of a scalar field, usual action of a scalar field. So I choose for my space-time with cutoff some Riemannian manifold, and then on it, the action of the scalar field might look like this. This is in the position basis. If I choose the eigenbasis of the Laplacian, then this same action looks like that, of course, because the field phi in the eigenbasis of the Laplacian is just the coefficients of the field in the eigenbasis of the Laplacian. And here we have the eigenvalues of the Laplacian, the trivial change of basis from the position basis to the Laplacian eigenbasis. We can also write the whole thing basis independently. You can write the action as a trace of this operator applied to that operator. Well, I'm using a bracket-like notation. Of course, it doesn't mean that these are states in quantum mechanics. These are just fields in the abstract Hilbert space of fields on the manifold. So this action can certainly be written in this way in a basis-independent form. Now you may ask, well, what about the gravity action? This should be terrible, because you know, we are working here with the eigenvalues of the Laplacian and the coefficients of the field in the eigenbasis of the Laplacian and so on. And in order to write down the Einstein action, what would we need to do? We would need to take the eigenvalues, it would seem at least, we would need to take the eigenvalues of the Laplacian, which specify our manifold. Then we find some Riemannian manifold whose Laplacian has those eigenvalues. Then we calculate the metric on that Riemannian manifold. From that, we can calculate the curvature tensor. And then we take suitable contractions to end up with a Ricci scalar. And then we can integrate this over and get the Einstein action, right? Looks like a pretty messy thing, and a lot of it would be implicit, because it's not easy to find, in general, a Riemannian manifold for a given spectrum that you may want. So it would seem that it's a rather circuitous thing in this framework to write down the Einstein action. It turns out, again, there is fortunately a shortcut, a tremendous shortcut. It's very, very fast. For that purpose, let's look at what we have. This is an action which contains the degrees of freedom of the field. It also contains already the eigenvalues of the Laplacian. But there's one quantity here, one degree of freedom, which doesn't yet have an action. Remember that we are looking at finite chunks of space, which could be very big, but finite chunk. And on a finite chunk, the dimension of our Hilbert space of fields is finite dimension. We call to this dimension n. It's the overall size of the system. It's the overall size of the Hilbert space. That's a degree of freedom. So far, we haven't written down an action for the degree of freedom that describes the overall size of the system, capital N. So let's give it a shot. Let's say we write down the simplest possible action we can think of for N, the overall size of the system. Well, let's say the action is simply N, up to some constant in front of it, which we may have to fix one way or the other. So let's just add that, so that the overall size of the system has its own dynamics as well. Now, what is n? how do we get a feeling for what that action would be? N, the number of eigenvalues of the Laplacian below the Planck cutoff. What is that? Well, you can also write it as the trace of 1, of course, right? Because the trace of 1 is the trace of the identity operator, and that's just the number of dimensions in the Hilbert space, right? So what we are suggesting here is to say that our action is the usual action for a matter field plus 1, or plus alpha times 1, right? Now, what do we do when we do that? Do we just get the constant, or is that interesting dynamically? All right, I think I made enough fuss about it. It turns out that the trace of 1 is the Einstein action. And but it shouldn't be too surprising. It shouldn't be too surprising. You see, it's an old result of spectral geometry that the number of eigenvalues of the Laplacian below a threshold lambda is given by this expansion here, where you recognize that this is basically a cosmological constant, and that's the Einstein action. And then there are higher powers in R and higher powers in the inverse Planck length or Planck scale. Now, one could make a bit of fuss about this, but I shouldn't, because really it had to be predicted. It had to come out this way. Remember the work of Andrei Sakharov, 1969, one of the shortest papers ever. It's like a page or so. Very short. And he made the point that whenever you have any candidate theory of random gravity which reduces at low energies to quantum field theory and curved space, let me repeat that. Whenever you have any quantum gravity candidate theory which reduces to quantum field theory at low energies, and every candidate quantum gravity theory should do that, whenever you have such a theory, it will induce the Einstein action. It's automatic. If you don't put it in there, it will be induced at the latest when you do the renormalization of it. And so it's no wonder that theories like non-commutative geometry, which do that, or string theory, which do that, come up with Einstein gravity. They have to. There is no way around it. And so in this case as well, we have a cutoff. We arrive at low energies at ordinary quantum field theory on curved space. And so there was no way around it. It had to materialize this way. We had to get the Einstein action out. And we got it in this way. So if we choose this parameter alpha that we had in front of the Einstein action, of the number of degrees of freedom, if we choose this parameter alpha to be 6 lambda, then this actually becomes exactly the Einstein action with the cosmological constant term. The cosmological constant, the cosmological constant comes out far too big. That's the usual problem. And we are not solving that, the cosmological constant problem here at all. We're just looking at it from a different perspective. But there's one thing we can see here. We get an interpretation of this now. Namely, see, what do we have here? We have here the number of samples that we have to take of a finite chunk of space-time, finite chunk of volume V. This is the number N of samples we have to take to be able to reconstruct both the shape of the space-time and the fields that might live on that space-time. So this is the number of degrees of freedom, so to speak, in that finite volume chunk of space-time. Now, what is this first term? Just this. Neglect the curvature piece over there. Just this first term. But this bit is just the volume, of course, of our chunk of space-time. So if we divide that over here, we get the number of sample points that we have to take in this volume divided by that volume. So that's the density of sample points. Can view it as the density of degrees of freedom. It's simply lambda squared over 32 pi. That's what we get over here. Okay. So this is to say that the cosmological constant seems to express that, since this is of order 1, that there's basically 1 degree of freedom per volume. I'm neglecting issues of holography here, I realize that. But this is what comes out this way. And more than that, we see that if there's curvature, it screws up this argument. Or, positively speaking, we can view curvature as a modulation of the density of degrees of freedom. If there's no curvature, the density of degrees of freedom is this. This many samples you need to take to be able to reconstruct your field everywhere. If there is curvature, that density changes. So it can be viewed as changes. Curvature can be viewed not only as making parallel transport non-trivial, it can also be viewed as a modulation of the density of degrees of freedom that you have in the space. Yes, yes, and I'm thinking here of the Euclidean-ized version, so I've recreated the whole four-dimensional.
I think there's one check on this, which is the sign has to be correct. If Sakharov's calculation gave the wrong sign.
Well, actually, the thing is a subtle one, and I don't quite know what the answer is, because bosons and fermions generally contribute with opposite signs. And it's not obvious whether there are more fermions or more muon species. So it's a subtle thing, and I think if we knew exactly how many bosons and how many fermion species there are, we could add up the vacuum energies and we could see what's winning, a positive or a negative sign. I don't know. This is just a crude first thing which only looks at bosons, and for the bosons it comes out with the right sign. Actually, you see, the bosons will, by renormalization, contribute
something more of the kind. This term, if you remember, doesn't come from the actual boson. This was just the action that I wrote in there by hand, just n. But it's of course true that this is going to be renormalized and so on. This is just
the likely to deal with.
Yes.
Perfectly.
Yeah, I know.
It's not a.
Yeah, yeah. In principle, you can do it, but
it's been done. What? Those notations, yes. The things that replace lambda over 6 for scalars. Are known for all the fields that we're ever likely to come across.
Yes, this can be done, but my point was that we don't really know what fields we have. I mean, are we really sure that the fields in the standard model are all the fields there are? Right? And there could be other fields, and ultimately everything would enter into this, not just the fields that we can access now. But you're right, in principle, the mathematical stuff is there. It's just that I'm not so sure about the physical.
Now, this all may be fine and good, but is there any evidence that something like that might be the case? But remember that uncertainty principle thing here? I said that there are some studies of quantum gravity and string theory, not all of them agree on this, but there are some, which say that eventually what should happen is that the uncertainty principle will be modified such that we can't get arbitrarily close anymore to this line, which means that something like a minimum uncertainty in position is a feature of nature. Now, it can be shown, and that's actually not hard. It's just a few lines on the basis of functional analysis. So no physical input, just mathematics. It can be shown that if you have any operator x, which has this property that the standard deviation calculated from it has a finite lower bound, then you can prove on basis of sheer functional analysis that whatever fields this operator might act on, and they might be fields to be summed over in the path integral, wave functions, or some other abstract stuff, whatever fields it might act on, those fields obey a sampling theorem. It's automatic. This is no proof, of course, but it's encouraging, I think, that basically one can say that if that is happening, then sampling theory is happening. Is there any experimental evidence for this? Now, obviously, if there were any, it would be a big deal. But no, of course not. But is there any chance? Well, it turns out that applications to inflationary cosmology are pretty easy, roughly speaking, because something like Fourier still works, because we are working with something so close to flat space that basically you don't have to go into sophisticated math to do it. And so this whole sampling theoretic approach can be done pretty easily for inflationary cosmology, and has been done. And several groups have worked out what the predictions for the cosmic microwave background would be. Roughly speaking, there are two. And the experimental signatures would be of two kinds. One is that there could be modulations in the CMB power spectrum. Or maybe I should say that beforehand. I mean, why look at inflation for the purpose of checking Planck scale physics? Well, you know, of course, that if we tried with accelerators, we would see that accelerators can perhaps resolve 10 to the minus 19 meters, but not 10 to the minus 35 meters. So we are 16 orders of magnitude off. However, in cosmology, if inflation is right, then the fluctuations which seeded the large-scale structure of space-time, actually were frozen in place when they crossed the so-called Hubble horizon, and that was only when they were about 5 orders of magnitude larger than the Planck scale, which means that Planck scale physics could have left some imprint in those fluctuations which later seeded the large-scale structure of space-time and which we can actually experimentally access. And since there are only 5 orders of magnitude, maybe perhaps even only 4 in size between the Planck length and the Hubble length during inflation. Well, all right, 7. But it's better than 16. Okay. You can have 5. All right. So in any case, much better than 16. So the point is that there is a slightly, we have better odds at finding a signal. Of course, the CMB itself is a small signal. I mean, the fluctuations of the CMB itself are a small signal of 10 to the minus 6 in order.
Just because you don't see gravitational waves.
Yeah, I get to that in a moment. Right. Yeah. So
in any case, the chances are better than with accelerators. There are other things like that might reach to the such far scales, like breaking of Lorentz invariants or proton decay and so on. There are a few other things that might get into those magnitudes. But generally speaking, I think cosmology might be the best bet. So one of the signatures that you would see is modulations in the CMB power spectrum, which sounds great because we can measure it to very high precision, especially for the higher moment. We can measure it to really great precision. However, the problem is that even if we find modulations there, they could be due to many other causes as well. In particular, we don't know what the incident potential looks like. And if it has wriggles in it, they will show up in the spectrum of the CMB as well. So it's not really a strong signature. On the other hand, there could be, and that's been predicted from that approach, characteristic deviations from this scalar tensor consistency relation that we should be able to probe if we can measure bipolarization, which is a remnant of gravitational wave. Now, it's not clear whether we ever are going to measure the bipolarization because apparently the gravitational wave spectrum is very weak. But there is roughly, I mean, there's in principle there's a chance, and even the Planck satellite in principle might say. But it's very hard to measure. But if it were measured, then we would get a rather characteristic deviation. We would get the possibility to compare experimental data with a rather characteristic prediction for the deviation. So it's not completely out of the question that one could probe such a thing. Tiny. Yes, of course. It would be very tiny. I mean, it's a very, very long shot because we don't even know whether we will be able to measure the bipolarization. And on top of that, and you're right, on top of that, it would be an effect that's suppressed by at least 5, 6, maybe 7 orders of magnitude. Well, I would have to go through the calculations there. I mean, roughly speaking, you put that into the inflationary, the usual calculation, inflationary calculations, and then you just see that there is a bit of an imprint there. Basically, you can view it as a modification of the dispersion relation. Mathematically, it boils down to that in the simplest case. When you apply this cutoff to just the spatial part, so I'm not saying that we do the big rotation of the four-dimensional space-time and then carry the whole thing through, but rather we apply this cutoff in a Lorentz breaking way to just the space-like hypersurfaces, which is perhaps not very appealing, but it's the only thing we can do at the moment. But there is work underway which is trying to do it fully covariantly with my student Robert Martin. Okay, so the summary is this. Space-time could be discrete and continuous in the same way that information can. This would combine the languages of quantum theory and general relativity. Remember, spectral geometry is a really intriguing piece of mathematics because it combines functional analysis. You see the eigenvalues of an operator. That's the language of quantum theory. It combines functional analysis with differential geometry. the language of general relativity. It seems to be a natural piece of mathematics to come up in quantum gravity. It expresses a minimum length uncertainty principle. And we would have that fields, actions, equations of motions, and so on, would possess completely equivalent representations either on a space-time manifold or on any lattice of sufficiently dense spacing. Gravity would be described via eigenvalues of the Laplacian. One nice feature would be that the representational degrees of freedom coordinate system choices would be modeled out because you work directly with the eigenvalue. And you see, when you write down a metric on a Riemannian manifold, a lot of what the metric represents is just the choice of coordinates. And that's not what you want to quantize. So you have to mod this out, and it's just a mess. But if you work with just the eigenvalues themselves, you see, they don't have that ambiguity. Every little bit counts in the eigenvalues of the Laplacian. You change the eigenvalue a little bit, the manifold changes its shape. The Anschaun action would be automatically induced, but it's not a big deal because Sarov showed us that it has to be. Whenever you write down anything that has an ultraviolet cutoff and reduces to at low energies to quantum field theory, the Anschaun action is induced. There are obvious things that need to be done. Lorentz covariant formulation, there is some work out, on that out there, and new work is coming up. Also, this is just one half of the picture when you talk about information. This was just dealing with the degrees of freedom. You still have to think about the noise in the system, because a capacity in information theoretically is always a combination of bandwidth and noise. And in our case, we always have quantum noise. Now, a recent paper I put out on the archive with a student, Matthew Cleef, is addressing exactly the issue. What does space-time look like as a quantum channel within this framework where the noise is the noise from quantum fluctuations of speed? Now, of course, to be honest, all of this may have nothing to do with nature, right? We should always keep that in mind, that as long as we don't have experiments, we don't know. So what if it has nothing to do with nature? Well, on one hand, whenever you develop new methods in sampling theory, then you have a chance that it might be useful in where sampling theory comes from, communication engineering, signal processing, and so on. And actually, that has happened already. I have one patent and another patent pending on that stuff. But for the purpose of physics, I would argue that covariant sampling theory should at least give us some mathematical tools. Even if nature is not like that, it should at least give us some nice tools, just like in number theory, where you have theories that you want to sum up, but you're lacking the tools for that. So you use sampling theory to write it as an integral, for which you can then use contour integration and other stuff. So similarly here, if you have a discrete theory of quantum gravity, you may want, just as a technical trick, to write it as a continuous theory, so that you'd find out different equations, become differential equations, and then try to solve it more easily this way. I haven't done this at all yet, but I would be very happy to explore that with whoever is interested. And potential benefits of using some covariant sampling theory in quantum gravity theories would be, for example, that one could define the dimension of a lattice. If you just have a set of points, a distance relation, with this approach, you could define what the dimension of that lattice is. Or you could enforce a dimension. You could express something in terms of the, you could take the Laplace operator and look at its asymptotic behavior. That is a one-to-one correspondence to the dimension. You could put that as a constraint in your action, which will stabilize the dimension, for example. Also, you may not have to take a continuum limit, because you might be able to reconcile discrete and continuous formulations in this way. I'm running out of steam. Thank you very much. Oh, yeah.
One slide, Okay. Not this one, yeah. Lorentz signature sampling came up. So we are not as far with this because Lorentzian spectral geometry is much less developed. Only a few people have ever given it a shot, which is unfortunate, but it's also understandable because it's much harder. The reason is that the D'Alembert shape is not an elliptic operator, it doesn't have a body operator. The whole thing becomes much more complicated in this scale. Nevertheless, there are some results on it. For Minkowski space, the whole thing can be done, not a problem. But when you put curvature into it, then it gets a little bit
hairy. But there is work soon to be posted on that, where we do the inflationary calculations in a covariant way. I mean, really Lorentz covariant way, locally Lorentz covariant way. Now you may wonder how on earth could that ever work in the Lorentzian case? Because can we ever have the smallest wavelength covariantly? Shouldn't it always be possible to go into a boosted frame and then it looks shorter? But sure, of course, it should. And that's what happened. And what happened is that sampling theory becomes a two-part thing. You have to always distinguish now between spatial modes, Fourier transforming with respect to space, spatial modes, and temporal modes, Fourier transforming with respect to time. And you find that spatial modes obey a temporal sampling theorem, and temporal modes obey a spatial sampling theorem. And you find that time dilatation and Lorentz contraction just work together to make the whole thing covariant. Roughly speaking, what's happening is this, that as you look at wavelengths that are shorter and shorter and shorter, when they become shorter than the Planck length, the bandwidth in time becomes extremely low, which means that the evolution becomes frozen, because you need to know what's going on only at large intervals in time, and you can reconstruct everything that goes on in between. So basically, it's no longer the case, fully Lorentz covariantly, that there are no degrees of freedom shorter than the Planck length. It's just that they are dynamically frozen. They become trivial because their bandwidth goes very quickly, very close to zero. And that is a covariant thing, because what is low bandwidth in time depends on the observer because of time dilatation, but also what is short wavelength in space depends on the observer because of Lorentz contraction. And the whole statement that wavelengths shorter than the Planck length become dynamically frozen because their bandwidth becomes low is a covariant statement that we can tell. It's just a little bit hard to generalize that to in the presence of curvature, because you can't do Fourier anymore. But in principle, it should be possible. Should we go further or allow for other questions?
In the part you showed that sampling exactly holds for functions for band limited functions, that only holds for functions which are infinite in time. Any real sound, for example, is finite in time. So you can hold the function with a rectangle, with a rect function, which just becomes infinite in bandwidth. So assuming a band-limited function gives you a corresponding infinity in its point-limited space.
Yeah.
So you assume you band-limited your field. So what's the infinity that is implied in that space?
Right. So for engineering purposes, the statement that the sampling theory gives you exact reconstruction has to be modified a little bit, because you're right. If you impose a strict frequency cutoff, then the function cannot be totally confined in time anymore. So your signal, in principle, would have to spread infinitely much out in time. And that means that it doesn't suffice for a music signal to take a finite number of samples. Of course, you do take a finite number of samples, and the cost you pay is that you have a tiny error there. And the same thing is happening in physics. You put this ultraviolet cutoff there, and then your fields cannot be completely localized anymore anyway. You always have to have some little tail that spreads out everywhere. But those tails decay very quickly.
Yeah,
all time. It depends. When you do the covariant thing, of course, the whole thing is up. So I would say that for engineering purposes, there's a real issue. You have to make sure that the error is small enough. But for the purpose of physics, we can always assume that we know the samples to arbitrary position. We can assume that we measure infinitely many samples and so on. For practical purposes, yes. If you cut things off, you incur some more. Yes?
So you say that any piece of a Euclidean manifold actually corresponds to an equivalence class of manifolds with the same spectrum when there's a UV cutoff. So if we say that, you know, this is a valid physical picture, then does that sort of imply the presence of like a finite temperature, some sort of finite temperature fluctuations because of these unobservable, you know, fields which are below the or above the Planck's?
Well, I don't know. Maybe it could be done, but that's not the way I thought of it. I thought of it as a mere issue of representation. See, you can say that when you look at the Riemannian manifold, then any coordinate system you put on it is just a matter of representation. And you wouldn't think of making the choice of representation an actual degree of freedom that would correspond to some entropy or so. Right? You wouldn't do that. And similarly here, I would say that a space-time is specified by its eigenvalues up to the cutoff, and then the rest is just representation theory. You might, of course, say that, well, maybe it's some sort of hidden variable. Maybe they are exposed to some underlying temperature that accounts for quantum uncertainty. I don't know. Maybe that sort of thing could be done, but that's not how I thought of it. I just think of it as a matter of representation.
Maybe the last question? Okay. So on the slide with the two-point functions and the sampling density, so am I correct to carry away from this that if you have any space with like a sampling theorem, you can find out the sampling density empirically just by taking more and more samples, and once your once the Laplacian becomes well conditioned, you get the sampling density?
Yes, that's right. It's a bit complicated if you want to if you take just a chunk of a bigger spacetime.
But if you take, let's say, a finite volume spacetime, let's say it's compacted, let's say it has no boundary. In that case, yes. You can take samples and try to reconstruct, and the mathematics will tell you when you have enough points. And then when you have enough points, adding more points will only help the convergence, will help the stability, but you don't get any more information out of it.
In practice, you only have a finite volume of space you can sample out of the Laplacian manifold.
Again, what was the question?
In practice, you can only sample a finite volume of space.
Yes, that's right.
So can you quantify the error that comes from that cutoff?
Well, if you make it really big, I mean, think of
looking at a ball in the universe of 100 billion light years. What could the error be? I mean, for all practical purposes, the boundary is not mattering.
Sure, but if you believe that the laws of nature are more or less local,
okay.
Infrared cutoff generally is not so much of a concern.
Speaking of cutoffs, that's